floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. Greetings, good friends and neighbors, and welcome to Walking the Floor. I'm Chris Shiflett, and today I'm going to be talking with photographer, director, and now host of his own talk show off camera, my friend, Mr. Sam Jones. But first, I just want to say thanks to everybody that came out to those Dead Peasants gigs we did up in Santa Barbara at the Soho and down in Silver Lake at the Grand Old Echo. They were both super fun, and sadly, we don't have any gigs booked at all right now, and nothing on the horizon, so we got to remedy that situation soon. And you know, up in Santa Barbara, we had a very special guest in the audience that night. And I'm glad I didn't know he was there before we went on stage, because I would have been nervous as all get out. But Brad Paisley was there. Brad Paisley, country royalty, a ripper, a guitarist's guitarist, Brad Paisley. So I'm glad I didn't know he was there, because I would have been blowing my Don Rich licks left and right. But he came up afterwards and said some nice things. And of course, I hit him up to be on the podcast. So he said he'd do it. We'll see. I'm going to definitely try to get him to stick to that. So look for that soon on Walking the Floor. All right. Let's get to Sam Jones. I met Sam Jones a few years back when our kids were attending the same preschool. Now, there we were one morning, just a couple of dads out pushing our children on the swings, when it came up in casual conversation that he had directed one of my favorite movies, I Am Trying to Break Your Heart, about the trials and tribulations of the band Wilco. I think my eyes just about bugged out of my head, because I consider that one of the greatest rock docs of all time and required viewing for musicians everywhere. We became fast friends, bonding over our love of Bakersfield, vintage guitars, and really all things music-related. Because if you know Sam, you know that he is a passionate, passionate music fan. So I recently sat down with him at his amazing new studio, and we talked about his progression over the years, from Orange County skate rat, to budding photographer, to director, to now stepping out in front of the camera to host his own talk show off camera. And this is what he had to say. Check it out.
I'm hiding out in the big city blanket.
All right, should we start?
Yeah.
Well, let's start at the start. You grew up in Fullerton, right?
Fullerton, California.
Fullerton, California. Can you describe for me what that was like growing up in Fullerton in the 1970s? Because my vision of it would be, you know, that it was still part of that, like, you know, sort of West Coast California utopian, you know, orange orchards around and sunshine and skateboarding and all that sort of stuff. What was it like for you growing up there?
Yeah, there was all that. You know, my folks were born there or grew up there as well. And there were a lot of orange orchards, and I actually was a gardener in my first entrepreneurial business, and I actually watered orange trees for a guy down the street, and there was, you know, I was lucky enough to be sort of in that explosion of skateboarding where the precision bearing came in and the urethane wheel came in, and all of a sudden skate parks started popping up. So there was Concrete Wave and Skatopia, and so all of a sudden every kid skateboarded,
right?
You know, but what I really remember most about Fullerton being sort of developmentally shaping my background was when I was around 14 years old, the whole sort of punk rock thing happened in Fullerton.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to, is if it was this beautiful place, why was it the epicenter for like the Orange County punk rock scene? I mean, you had the Adolescents, Social D, Agent Orange, all those bands were around that area. Like, why, if it was, you know, the way I sort of envision it, why was there this underlying aggression and anger? Like, where did that come from?
Well, I think it's the same as a lot of communities in the 70s. I think it was a reaction to parents in the 70s.
It's our parents' fault.
Totally our parents' fault. I mean, I remember...
You realize our kids are going to use that against us in a few years,
too. Oh, exactly. I remember, you know, we had the Racquet Club in Fullerton, and that's where you first started hearing divorces happening, because the parents would join the Racquet Club, and then, you know, they'd be out late drinking, and they wouldn't be home with the kids, and then... You heard a story about, oh, someone's mom caught in the back seat of some other father's car at the Racquet Club.
Not in Fullerton.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I don't know, but I think that in general in the 70s, there was a lot of divorce in our country. And, you know, Fullerton was this suburban place that was very small town, but I think just like any other place, that went on, that rippled through the country where sure. you just had a lot of, you know, you just had a lot of parents who were really not maybe paying attention to their kids so much, and you had a lot of things changing, and that's my theory. And also, you know, we had the Fender factory, and so there was a couple pawn shops in town that you could get guitars really cheap in Fullerton.
Really? So that was still there when you were a kid?
Yeah, that was still there, and you know, there was always stories of some kid who dumpster dived and came up with a neck and a Strat body, and all they had to do was put them together and paint them themselves, and they'd have a Strat. And,
yeah, yeah.
And I remember my first guitar was actually a Gibson, which is ironic, but it was a 56 Les Paul Junior that I got at the pawn shop for $75.
Right.
And so, you know, there was...
How old were you at that point? Like, when did you start playing music?
I was...
For those that don't know, you're
okay,
also...
Okay, so when I was 16, I was in my first band, and that's when I got that guitar. And you know, it was extremely amateurish. It was a three-piece, and we would play Clash and Violent Femmes, and you know... We'd play Joe Jackson, we would play Elvis Costello stuff, and but the interesting thing, I think, was that there was this, you know, there was the drought, which, so there was a lot of empty pools, there was divorce, there was a lot of foreclosed houses, so there were, you could find an empty pool in someone's backyard and go skating, and there was great music. Not only in Fullerton there, but there was just great music happening that time. So, like, I remember my eighth grade summer, it was Foreigner doing Hot Blooded, and then some kid put up a skateboard ramp in his backyard, and his parents were never home because they were getting a divorce. So you'd go over there, you'd skate the half pipe, you'd listen to like 70s rock radio. Like, this was even before punk rock happened,
right,
and
right.
you were free. And so I don't know. I'm sure it happened in all kinds of communities, but Fullerton had that weird thing of great weather, some skate parks, and the Fender factory.
Right.
You know, and Social Distortion, their first or second gig was my eighth grade dance.
Seriously?
At my junior high school. So yeah.
And who was in charge of who made that mistake?
Well, that's a good question. And then Fullerton High School would have bands on Fridays at lunch. So
oh,
we
wow.
saw the Adolescents at our school. We saw
right.
Agent Orange. Saw D.I.
So all those bands. I mean, they would have only been a little bit older than you anyway, right?
Yeah.
Was that just around the, you know?
It was. And my friend Ed Caspers, his dad had a construction company, and he also rented a series of little garages that were like little, you know, like the kind of place where you, if you were a little metal fabricator, you'd rent a little garage mm-hmm. and do your work out of it.
Right.
And he had this little row of tiny warehouses, like little garage warehouses, and the bands would practice there. So Ed and I would ride our bikes down and, you know, sit outside and listen to these bands practicing.
Yeah. So while, you know, punk rock and skateboarding and all that's happening, when did photography become an interest for you? Were you like the kid back then that was always had the camera, was taking pictures of your friends and documenting everything?
I was not. I was...
How did that
start? You know, I'll tell you what happened. I was really into skateboarding, and I met Neil Blender, who's a pro skater.
Sure.
And I met him when I was 19 because he lived in Fullerton, and we heard he skated this like curb at Cal State Fullerton, and it was a really long red curb. It was perfect, and I would skate the same curb, and eventually I met Neil and we became friendly, and Neil was really into photography, and he would shoot all his own ads for GNS.
Oh, really?
And so we'd start to go to these skate spots, and Neil was like, oh, why don't you shoot and I'll do some things. So one of my first things I shot ever became an ad for GNS of Neil doing an ollie at Sadlands. And so he sort of taught me, like he said, you know, he told me the lens to get to shoot skating.
Right.
He showed me like filters and so, and then right around then I took a photo class at Cal State Fullerton.
So you're out of high school at this point.
I was out of high school, yeah. And, but because I knew Neil and we would go to the same skate spots, my earliest photo assignments where it was like, you know, do, the assignment was sports. You know, I'd come back with a picture of like, you know, Mike McGill doing a aerial, you know, at Upland Skate Park, or Gator Rogowski doing a, you know, doing something on a backyard ramp somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. And it started out as a way to sort of document the skating. And to be quite honest, it was the first time that I found something at school that I actually liked to do.
Right.
You know, and the first time I sort of like, it still seemed like a job to me because I really just wanted to skate and play music. But I got more and more into being in the dark room and developing and you know, the hours would go by and I was, and I started realizing, well, this is something that I love that I could actually make into a career.
Right.
You know?
So that's when it went from, like, did you go to photo school, photography school or anything like that?
Well, I did. Cal State Fullerton had two things that were pretty amazing. They had a daily newspaper, and their daily newspaper had its own photography department with its own darkroom. Hmm. So if you were on staff at the newspaper, you got to use this darkroom. And so I got on staff at the newspaper, and then I became the photo editor, which means I could basically sleep in the darkroom like it was my own darkroom. Whereas if you were just in a photo class at the school, you had to share the communal darkroom with like a bunch of students who, you know, I mean, this is getting techie, but they would foul the stop bath, or they'd, you know, you'd put your print in the fixer and it would come out looking terrible because someone had not done the right steps, and,
right,
or someone was turning on the light or lifting up their enlarger and the light would bleed. And so I got really into the process of going in late at night to the newspaper office and developing and printing my work. And I just loved it. I love sleeping at the school and working all night. And then they had a daily newspaper. So you had to work every day. You had to shoot pictures every day.
I remember you said something to me years ago, and I'm going to butcher it, and so you can correct me if I get this completely wrong here, but you said something to the effect of that your job was to come up with crazy ideas and then figure out how to actually make them happen.
Yeah, that's pretty much my job.
Is that when you started to develop that? Because, I mean, to go back to your parents a little bit, or the, you know, your life growing up in Fullerton, like, where do you think that comes from? Because your parents weren't artists, right? Your dad was like a managed a race car track or something.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How did you go into being this creative? How did you grow into being this creative person instead of being like, you know, a grease monkey racetrack guy or what, you know what I mean? Like, where does that come from?
I think it comes from The Muppet Show and David Letterman. I think that really early on, like, I used to think it was David Letterman and Doonesbury that really got me into my irreverent state of the humor I liked. But then with my kids, we got the Muppet Show DVDs and I started watching them, and I realized a lot of my irreverence and attitude towards the world came from that show and how, you know, how you didn't take yourself too seriously, fruit should be thrown a lot, jokes could be made, and you know, and I think my whole life, I mean, I grew up, you know, we grew up in an outdoor culture because it was hot and the parents weren't around, so we would amuse ourselves by putting a present in the street and filling it up with dog crap and hiding in the bushes, waiting until someone pulled over, and, you know, throwing avocados or oranges. You know, my high school had a very famous junior-senior orange fight every year, where at midnight the juniors and the seniors would go to the Fullerton golf course armed with thousands of oranges. And you basically hucked oranges at each other until police came.
Something tells me that doesn't happen these days.
I don't know.
I don't think it does anymore.
Yeah. Somebody would claim bullying and it would just, you know.
Yeah, but I think that's where it comes from, is always trying to entertain ourselves, you know, and trying to one-up our friends, or trying to, you know, it was never just let's skate down the street. It's let's tie a rope to the back of that guy's bike and hold on to it and see if we can get going fast, or hang on to a car, or whatever it was. So when photography started becoming important to me, I didn't want to make the pictures that I saw other students making. Mm-hmm. I wanted to come up with something crazier.
Right.
And if the idea was good enough, the picture would be easy.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because it was already something crazy happening.
Right.
And all you had to do was take the picture. Right. So I think from an early age, I realized that an idea can make a photograph great. And whereas I never had this strict adherence to purity of photojournalism, where you had to be at the right place at the right time. I responded more to pictures that were as much a creation as they were, you know.
Well, that's a huge part, I think, of realizing art of any kind, is actually having, it's one thing to have the idea, it's a whole other thing to have the courage to make it happen.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think people definitely play to their own strengths. And for me, my strength was in the idea. It was not always in the execution. I never had a whole bunch of patience for lighting. Like, I would see students that would, you know, spend 2 hours lighting a bell pepper because they wanted a photograph like Edward Weston, you know, or a still life of something. And for me, I just never, I never had the patience for it, or it just didn't speak to me. So for me, I think that my strength was if I could imagine a picture in my head, then the rest was just like, you know, solving a problem at that point. Like, you know, we got to get the gasoline and, you know, light it on fire and then have this guy jump through. And, you know, you just...
The moment that comes to mind is when you convinced me to stick my iPhone into a Ziploc bag so we could film ourselves going down the water slide. That's like a classic Sam Jones moment.
Well, it was funny because you had the brand new iPhone at the time that was the first one with video.
Right.
You know? And, yeah. And so I thought...
And it worked.
Yeah,
it was well executed. Great idea.
That's right.
So how did it go? How did photography go from being just something that you were, you know, interested in going, you know, as a hobby, to actually being a career? Like, how does somebody go from, I don't know what your early jobs as a photographer were, but how do you go from being a kid in college shooting pictures of your friends skateboarding to, you know, shooting George Clooney and these like superstars, beautiful portraits for Vanity Fair? That seems like a huge leap. What was your path?
Well, it started at college and having the daily newspaper. You know, after I think 3 photo classes, I got on at the paper, and it was immediately a job. And when you think about it, the execution was the same. You had to go out, find a picture, make it, and develop it and print it, and had to be good enough to put in the paper the next day, right? So I went straight from that into working for the Associated Press.
Hmm.
Which is a long, boring story that I won't tell, but I shot sports for the newspaper at my college, and I got lucky enough that some of those pictures were seen by the Associated Press, and they said, well, you could freelance for us and shoot sports for us. And so I was actually working for the Associated Press before I left college. And so I did newspaper journalism on a national level for 3 years, being a freelancer for the Associated Press. And some of those pictures got seen by Tim Robbins, who was making a movie that had a big element of the press in it. It was called Bob Roberts.
And
it it was a satire about a senatorial race and how the media could be manipulated to win a political race.
Right.
And when Tim saw my pictures from the riots, and not even from the riots, but when the Rodney King incident happened and Chief Daryl Gates of the LA police force was in the middle of that controversy, I had to photograph him. And so Tim saw some pictures of him that Vanity Fair had picked up from the Associated Press of this police chief surrounded by media and being sort of embroiled in this scandal. And Tim said, those are the kind of pictures I want for the film.
Right.
And that's the feeling I want the film to have. So I got invited to come be the unit photographer,
oh, wow.
which is the day-to-day photographer on the set.
Right. Had you already developed, I mean, you have a pretty distinct style, you know, especially with your portrait stuff, the black and white, you know, the look of it. Had you already developed that?
No, I was literally just a journalist at that time. Although, let me say that again, because yes and no. I had been doing straight photojournalism for 3 years, but if you look at my last year of college, a lot of those portraits were already developed. Like, I was already coming up with weird ideas mm-hmm. in college, but then I'd pretty much been doing straight journalism. But on that film, luckily enough, Tim had a bunch of cameos from his friends, John Cusack and Susan Sarandon and Gore Vidal and a bunch of actors at the time that were pretty big actors, and they came in for a day on that film. And I pulled them all aside and I said, oh, the film needs a portrait of you, which was a total lie. It was, you know, and I'd just walk straight up to the actor and say, you know, before you leave, one of the things we have to do is we have to do a portrait of you.
Right. See, and this is an early lesson for you.
Exactly.
And like, if you just have the guts to try it, you know, then that's how those things happen.
Exactly. And, you know, what I notice is actors have a lot of downtime. So if I could set up something
and love
off
having
the corner,
their picture taken.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so and what I would do is I would shoot. I remember one thing in particular. Gore Vidal was played a senator in the film, and I pulled him aside and I did a portrait of him, and then I showed the pictures the next week to the DP, who was this great guy, Jean Lapine, who was Robert Altman's DP, and he was very good at like lighting naturally and everything, and he would literally look at my film and go, oh, you know, your key light's a little too high. Here's what I would do, and he'd show me. And so I really went to school on that film.
Wow.
and sort of, you know, learned a lot from watching him work, and he sort of critiqued my portraits, which is great because he wasn't a photographer, he was a DP.
Right.
So I got more of a naturalistic cinematic sense of how to light. And I walked away from that film with a portfolio. And that's how I started developing my thing.
Is that what led kind of directly to the Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair and the work?
Well, yeah, then I just went into full entrepreneur, you know, I went into this sort of, I'm going to just knock on doors and see if I can get anyone to hire me. So I started flying myself to New York and staying on friends' couches and making meetings with photo editors at magazines and sitting them down and showing them my work. And
right.
I can imagine what I must have looked like back then. I looked really, really young, and I was young. And I'd walk in, you know, and try to get a job. And finally, this photo editor at Entertainment Weekly took pity on me, and she gave me a job. And I was so excited. And then she said, we want you to photograph Tom Arnold's parking space. So I'm like, so will Tom Arnold be in the parking space? No, we just want the parking space. So my first job was to shoot a parking space. And I must have shot like 20 rolls on the parking space. I lit it with colored gels.
Right,
and I
right.
got a security guard to like walk through
right.
so you see his shadow. And
have Tony Hawk ollieing over the parking
exactly.
space. What can I do to make this interesting?
Exactly. But I think they saw, again, I think they saw this kid who worked so hard on it. And they're like, okay. He killed himself on this stupid parking lot picture. Let's give him like a quarter page picture of an up and coming actor.
Right.
And so, you know, slowly I started getting those kind of jobs.
Right. Early on, did you always have an idea that you would move into directing? Was that always in the back of your mind, or did that happen over time?
You know, what's funny is that I am always directing on my photo shoots. I am always setting up scenarios. Like I literally try when I set up a portrait to give the person I'm shooting sort of the background information on what the picture is and sort of make it like I am, you know, directing them in this world. A good example is a shot I did of Steve Martin where we laid out 1,800 banana peels on a road at Universal Studios, and rather than having him stand in the spot where the light was, I wanted him to sort of walk through the bananas and I would shoot him more like photojournalistically or more capturing him like I was filming him.
Mm-hmm.
So he could get into this character. Because I said the idea is, you're so confident walking through this field of banana peels, you know you won't slip. So have that look on your face and do it with this confidence. So even before I was directing, I think I was always directing.
Right.
You know, so
right.
when it came up actually on a, I got hired by a, an advertising agency who had me doing some still advertisements, and then the art director said, do you direct? And I said,
and
no.
You answered, yes, of course.
Yeah, well, he said, do you want to, would you like to ever direct something? I said, yes. And he said, okay, well, I'm gonna put you up for something and you can write a treatment. And I said, great, I'll get you a treatment. You know, and then I had to go call somebody and say, what's a treatment? but that's how, you know, again, someone saw something in the photography and thought, I wonder if he can bring the thing he does in photography and make that same kind of vibe in a commercial
right.
directing sense.
So how did the Wilco movie come up? I Am Trying to Break Your Heart.
Well, I'll tell you, I did that one commercial. It was for a children's hospital. And it was the art director who I was shooting a bank campaign for. And he said, I love your, you know, I love the expressions and the characters you get out of people. That, you know, that warmth or whatever you get, would you like to do a commercial? And so I had that opportunity to direct this children's hospital commercial. And I had to find a production company who could actually produce the commercial. And my cousin's a sound man, and he directed me to a guy named Peter Abraham, who had a really small production company. And I went and did this one commercial, and Peter said, do you want to sign on here as a director and we'll try to get you work? And I was like, great, why not? That sounds great. And I think within 2 months I came to him and I said, I think I want to make a movie. I want to make a documentary. And the way that happened was I was literally at a Wilco show in New York, and they were playing the Summer Teeth record. And I was watching them, and I realized these guys are my contemporaries. They're my age, and they're doing really interesting stuff. And if I was around in 1964, I would see Bob Dylan and say, "This is my contemporary doing right. really interesting stuff."
Right.
So I wonder if I can make an interesting film, not about some hero I lionized like the Beatles or Dylan or the Rolling Stones or Neil Young, but could I make a film about someone who was my peer? And some band who was relevant right now to me.
Right.
And I started thinking about that, and I was like, well, if I want to make a documentary, it would be more exciting to do that about someone who's excited about their own thing right now. It's not historical. It's happening right now.
Sure.
So I wrote a letter to Wilco. I just wrote a letter to their manager.
So you didn't know them personally?
No, I cold
wrote them. You hadn't shot them or anything?
I hadn't, but again, photography helped me because I sent the letter to Reprise Records, who they were on at the time. Mm-hmm. And the PR person who got the letter knew my name because I had shot record covers.
Ah.
So when he passed it on to the band, he said, look, this isn't just some fan with a steady camera. You know,
yeah, this is a legit guy.
With a little camera.
Yeah.
This is an actual guy. Maybe you want to engage with this letter a little bit. So you know, I just poured my heart out in 3 pages and told them why I wanted to make a film. And I referenced all those films. I referenced Don't Look Back. I referenced Gimme Shelter. I referenced Let It Be.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff responded. He invited me to Chicago to sit down and talk about it. And by the time the dinner was over, I think he was willing to let me in on the process. And
right.
So
I mean, geez, they let you in, too.
They let me all the way in.
How excited were you? You know, as a director, especially it's your first movie, and the band is like falling apart. Their world is falling apart right before your eyes. All of it unplanned. They get dropped from their label. They're having the problems with the guitar player, and eventually he gets kicked out or quit or whatever. I mean, was that like, did you have to hide your excitement? That was, I mean, because on one hand, you know, you probably get to know these people and it's probably hard to watch, but at the other hand, you're probably sitting there going, oh my God, this is gold.
Well, you know, I'm so naive that I had the exact opposite reaction, which was when I came to do it, I said to Jeff, I want to make a film about making a record from like writing a song to when that song is out on stage and on the radio. And I want to follow the process. Mm-hmm. I'm so interested in the process of craft. I always have been.
Right.
And so And you know, and stupidly enough or naively enough, I also said, okay, I'll do the film, but you guys can't look at it till it's done. And Jeff agreed to it. And I just assumed that's how you have to do it to make a documentary. So 2 days before we start filming, Jeff calls and he says, you know, we've just let Ken Coomer go, the drummer.
Oh, you missed that.
I missed that.
Oh.
So all of a sudden I was like, well, how do I explain Wilco's history with this drummer who'd already started making demos for that record? So he's on the demos, and then they have a new drummer coming in. So that seemed like really difficult and in the way of my songwriting process movie.
And I didn't realize that things had started getting shaky before that even started.
Yeah, so when we walked in to film for the first time, it was Glenn's first day.
Oh, wow.
So Glenn was completely intimidated, and he walks in and there's cameras. And so, you know, we tried to film the story of why Ken Coomer was let go. We filmed interviews with Ken. Like, this whole Ken story we filmed, which was a giant pain because it was a really, you know, I was paying for it myself, so the budget was tight, and I didn't know what story to follow. And then when the stuff started happening with Jay, it was like, oh my God, how is this going to work into my songwriting craft movie, right? And then they get dropped, and I'm like, oh no, like, no one's ever going to hear this record. How is that going to work into my songwriting craft movie? And finally, I was like,
wait a minute, I'm making a different movie,
and I should focus on the different movie. So I probably woke up later than anyone else about what I was actually making.
Right.
And then once I did, I sort of gave myself over to that process.
Sure.
And I realized that this could be a bigger film about creativity than actually filming the creative process. This could be a film about art versus commerce,
right,
which is what every artist goes through when they have any kind of success. But really, I was late to the party, and I was actually upset as all these things were happening because
sure.
I had to spend more money and shoot more film, and it seemed as though Wilco was receding into obscurity through all these steps. I mean, Warner Brothers didn't want them. They dropped them. Jeff is firing Jay.
Right.
You know, the band is firing Jay.
Yeah, and all the elements of an implosion.
A total implosion. And I also had this completely unrealistic schedule in my head of, we will film from January to April. We will go on the road with them from April to June. And then we will put the film out in, you know, August.
Right.
And we ended up working on the film for almost 2 years to follow this whole story.
Mm.
The record didn't come out for, you know, it came out a year late, and it turned into a much more involved thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it took me a while to realize that, you know, that when you make a documentary, you can't be too set on what your story is. You have of course, you have to have a thesis and a reason for filming something, but you have to be open to the fact that it's real life and it can change.
Well, that, to me, that movie should be required viewing for anybody that's in a band, like on so many levels. That is, even if it's not the exact same story, everybody that does it for a while experiences all that same stuff.
I think that's really true. And I think that not even just a band, but any collaborative art where you are, I mean, if you're a director, if you are, you know, if you're working on a television show, if you're an actor, whatever it is, you will see parts of what you've gone through in that film, because Jeff and Jay were these two archetypical artists who both had strong vision for how something should go. And Jay, bless his heart, and RIP, the poor guy, you know, died recently. But I think Jay didn't quite understand that it was Jeff's band.
You could see that.
And I think part of that was Jeff, who loved Jay's collaboration enough that he let Jay believe it was a shared vision.
Right.
But in the end, it's Jeff's band.
Sure, sure.
And it
kind of upholds. I mean, I always think that great music tends to come out of compromises, you know, and flukes even in a way. And you could see that in that band, that even if it's ultimately Jeff's decision and Jeff's band, you know, it was more than that making those records.
And Jeff is a collaborative guy for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And he loves the idea of a band, and he loves the idea of letting letting things happen spontaneously and taking the best idea in the room. But the last thing Jeff, I think, wanted was a power struggle.
Right.
I think he, in his mind, he gave really generously and let the band really sort of take shape in a collaborative fashion.
Sure.
But it's his band.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
And I think Jay took that collaborative sense and thought that it was more of a collaboration than it was.
Right.
Which I think happens all the time in bands.
Oh, absolutely.
You yeah. know, because
totally common.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, skipping to what you're doing now, you know, having worked with you on a few things through the years, you know, you did the Walk video, and then you did video for me and that Fender thing that we did. Mm-hmm. You know, you're fun to work with. You know, you're not a heavy-handed director or photographer or any of that. You know, your sets are always a good time, and I'm wondering if that's what influenced you to come up with the idea for off-camera.
You know, I think that how do I say that?
Because you spend so much time on, you know, when you're working on something, kind of, even though you're not recording, it's like we have these moments all the time when you're shooting something, because it's a lot of hurry up and wait.
Right.
And I imagine you've gotten to know your subjects, you know, through the years in different ways. Is that sort of what led you down that path? Like, God, this is so great. I want to capture this.
Well, I will tell you that the reason it's called off camera, and the thing I've talked about a lot with people I work with over the years, is that when a shoot is done, whether it's directing or photography or whatever it is, documentary, my favorite experiences are not often the end result. They were the day themselves.
Sure.
And I think the best shoots come out of the best days. So if you have a really amazingly fun day and everyone feels collaborative and in the spirit of it, then good work results anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the most interesting conversations I've had have happened sort of while doing that. And so you see pictures, say I do pictures of, you know, Matt Damon for a magazine. The pictures only tell like a little part of the story. But to me, the memory is the conversation we had, or the, you know, the football game that came up spontaneously on the beach or whatever it is. And so the idea with off camera is, you know, once someone gives you their trust as an artist or as a photographer or as a director, you break down that barrier of intimacy, or you sort of, people bring their guard down when they trust you. And once someone trusts you and lets their guard down, they're not going to put it back up. Like, you'd have to ruin it.
Right.
So I found that when I started asking people to come do off camera and people would come do it, they already sort of trusted me, and they already sort of knew my general demeanor. And so I think that it made an environment where people can have a fairly real conversation. And I think those people know that that will be represented in a good light.
Right.
And I'm not out to get any kind of gossip or the, you know, scandal
or
whatever.
Gotcha.
I mean, it's back to the same thing with the Wilco documentary. I really love talking about and understanding the creative process. I feel like every time I do any kind of job with anybody, any kind of collaboration or interview or whatever, I'm learning something. And so off camera is really just a chance for me to sit in a room with no distractions and like go to school on
pick somebody's
these
brain
people.
That you
exactly.
respect.
So, you know, once I realized that, and then I started thinking, is there anything really like that out there? And there are versions or pieces of it, but I think off camera is unique in that it's completely about the person and their craft. It takes away all the artifice. It's not styled. There's no clothing sponsors. There's no set or background or audience to make you feel like it's a show. And I think what I wanted people to do was be able to let the show disappear and feel like they were just in the room having this conversation.
Right.
You know? And what I find is that the people I interview walk away feeling like it's a very different experience, because no one ever really asks them about, well, how do you actually look at a script and like, do what do you write in the margins of your script? How do you take it off the page, and how do you turn it into a person, or, you know, like the real craft things,
right?
That I think used to be way more common in our media world.
Sure,
you know, David Frost and Tom Snyder, people that would really sit down and want to know about these people as craftsmen or actors,
right?
And not like their royalty or celebrity,
right?
You know, so it's just something that I totally get. I get this benefit of kind of being in a room asking these people how they do what they do and how they right. got there.
On that note, what is your creative process? I mean, how does it differ between the different mediums that you work in? I mean, you know, how does what you do in photography different from what you do when you're directing a commercial or a video or something differ from how you prepare to interview Matt Damon or whoever it is that's coming on your show?
I think I can answer that by saying what is the same about all of them, and it's story. For me, when you can add context to something, that's what makes it valuable as a piece of art or as a photograph or a music video or a documentary. You have to understand the story you're telling, right? So for me, if I can find the story I want to tell first, then the art comes out better. So for a photograph, it's having a certain aspect or take on the subject and exploring that photographically. So you tell that story in photographs. But if it's a documentary, it's sort of the same thing. What story do you want to tell? What aspect of that personality do you want to bring out? And how do you want to relate it to the bigger world? And even with off camera, you know, the list is endless. When you put someone like Robert Downey in the chair, you could ask him, you know, you could go for 10 hours and only scratch the surface on all the things he's done. You could pick one film. So my challenge there is to pick a path, a story to tell, and have him help me tell his story about what I'm interested in.
Right.
So I think what ties my work together is trying to find a narrative that I'm interested in, and see if I can tell that narrative in a way that other people relate to it.
Right.
And it really is the same. You know, it's just you're working with different tools. As when you're making a photograph, you have to understand the parameters or the limitations of what kind of story you could tell with a photograph. You know?
Yeah. How has it been, you know, moving in front of the camera? Has that been a difficult transition? Were you immediately comfortable? Had you done any of that prior?
That's the worst part for me. I haven't done it other than, you know, sometimes there's behind the scenes videos made at photo shoots or music videos or whatever. But I did struggle with that at the beginning, and I realized that if it was going to be an honest conversation, the interviewer can't be off camera. It's a conversation. So it's not a list of questions. You have to sort of be able to put yourself in the interviewer's shoes or the other person's shoes and see how the conversation flows. So
right.
I think that's been a real learning curve for me. Cause you know, there's this difficulty of listening while also formulating your next question,
right?
Or trying to find a way to relate.
Trying to stick to a storyline and a little bit.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And because you know, I've been interviewed enough in my career that I know how distracting it is when someone isn't listening to the question they've
right.
asked you.
Right.
And I've been in that situation where, you know, somebody asks you a question, and then you start to answer it, and they turn and they whisper something to the cameraman, and you lose your train of thought.
Totally.
So what's been a total learning curve for me is being on camera, trying to listen, trying to stay right in the present moment, which is a great exercise, by the way. It's great to sit there and try to be completely in the present in the conversation,
right,
while also knowing that there's cameras on you.
Sure.
You know? And I think that, like anything else I've done, it started as an experiment, and so I'm sort of rolling with it. But that is hard for me. It's very hard for me to sort of come out from behind the camera, and even the idea that I'm allowed to.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, sure.
Like, that
who wants to hear
calling
from me?
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That whole, and that's all in your head.
It's all
you
in
know.
Your
the
head.
Minute you can let that go, that's when it gets comfortable.
Right, and that's. I mean, in a way, I think that any artist is sort of trying to solve things from childhood or solve psychological things right. through their work. And for me, I think it is partly trying to be, trying to feel like I'm allowed to do this stuff.
Sure.
I keep waiting for someone to come in and say, okay, you've had your fun, but now we're going to let the real people come in and take over.
Right.
I'm always amazed when I work with someone who I really respect or admire, and they, at the end, say, oh, I love that, or I like what we did, or whatever. You know, I think that's something for me that I'll always struggle with, that my ideas are good enough.
Or, sure.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge part of, I think, everybody in the any kind of artistic community, be it music, film, whatever it is, so much insecurity, you know, and riding that line, you know,
yeah.
it's I think that fuels so much of what we all do.
Yeah, I think that if you're not insecure about that stuff, you probably also aren't someone who's going to make all that effort
right.
to try to make something. Because if you're a really confident, well-adjusted person, why do you need to go make stuff?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You're happy just sort of being
just
fine.
Being, yeah.
Yeah, just being. But for me, I've always, I mean, I love to make stuff.
Right.
That is, I think that if I hit the lottery tomorrow, I would still be doing the same things. I would just not have to have any clients or not have to find any financiers.
Well, you know, kind of related to that, how has it been, how's the transition been so far going from off camera being on the internet, you know, doing it all yourself on your own schedule, presumably, I don't know if you were keeping it to a strict schedule before, and now moving it to DirecTV, where I assume it's a different kind of commitment. You must have a schedule that you're having to adhere to. Like, how has that affected the show and who you're booking? Are you getting into now where you're booking people that you don't really know or have a relationship with, and is that changing it?
Well, a couple things in there. One, yes, eventually my contact list was gonna run out.
Right.
and also, you know, I have a lot of interest in people who I haven't met, that it's really, you know, every time someone comes on this show that I have no prior relationship with, it's great because I know it's not so much they're doing me a favor, you know?
Right.
And it feels great. Like, we had Sarah Silverman on, and I never met her or worked with her at all. And she came on the show, and it still worked as a show. It didn't need that prior relationship.
Right.
You know? And that makes me feel good about it. But being on DirecTV is... it's a work in progress. They're still working out the schedule, and so are we. And my goal with the show is to only interview people that I'm interested in.
Right.
So for me, it's no fun to do if I feel like it's another job with another client.
Right.
And lucky for me, DirecTV is pretty open to whoever I want to have on.
Mm.
They are not giving me this mandate that the guest has to be, you know, famous or well-known enough to be,
right,
you know, to move the needle on their demographic ratings or whatever
it
is.
Yeah.
But it is a challenge to come up with 22 a year, because before DirecTV came along, I was doing one a month.
Right.
And now it's two a month. And so it's a challenge, and it's, you know, like anything else, my whole life I have jumped first and then looked for the landing second. Like with the Wilco documentary, I said I wanted to make a film before I had ever taken a documentary film class or even a film class, you know, and then I figured I'd figure it out along the way. And I've done that my whole life. I've taken the risk and then sort of figured it out later. You know, I'm the guy who lights the firework and then looks at the instructions afterwards. Oh, you're not supposed to hold this one in your hand. So I think with DirecTV, it was the same thing. You know, we got on the phone with them, and they said, how many can you make in a year? And I said, how many do you want? You know, so we're figuring it out is the short answer. But that's what makes it fun for me is
right.
like taking on a risk and then and then sort of figuring
that
it out.
Unknown because, quality there.
And look, I'm so lucky. It's on DirecTV. You know, it's all over the country.
Yeah.
And it's a chance to make something that a lot of people are going to see, and right. they don't have to go seek it out. They're, it's going to sort of just show up in their television.
Yeah.
And I, to me, I just feel like, you know, I sort of invented a television show in my office, and no one gave it, no one let me have it or hired me, and then I somehow sold it.
Right.
So that's sort of like, I don't know, to me, that's...
It totally adheres to the come up with the crazy idea and then make it happen.
That's right.
That's the, you know, kind of the, that's your principle of your life. It's great.
That's right. And I feel very lucky that, you know, because I guarantee you, I come across stuff every day where I feel like, God, that should be on TV. Like, that's right. way better than my right. thing or whatever. And I feel extremely fortunate that I've been able to, like, sort of... walk this, you know, walk this path of finding people that will let me do what I like to do, mm-hmm. rather than the other way around,
right.
you know?
Because
I think there's a lot of artists that fall into that thing of, if I can create something that is sellable and make it adhere to those things, I can sell it.
Right.
So they just start out by trying to make someone else's thing rather than their own.
Right.
And I've been super lucky that I haven't always had to do that.
You know, can we talk about what you're currently working on now, or is that all
yeah.
top secret?
Oh, absolutely.
We can,
yeah.
Okay, about the Dylan project.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what it is.
Okay, well, in November of last year, I got a call from T-Bone Burnett and Jeff Rosen. Jeff Rosen manages Bob Dylan, and T-Bone Burnett obviously is a multiple Grammy winning producer
sure.
who did Oh Brother Where Art Thou,
and, right. and he toured with Dylan back
and
in the Rolling Thunder
Dylan,
tour, right?
The Rolling Thunder tour, T-Bone was a guitar player on there, and
is that kind of what put him on the map?
I think so, and I think that T-Bone seems to be one of these guys with the Midas touch where he makes a record and he wins a Grammy,
or right.
he makes a record, and a lot of people find out they really need more bluegrass in their record collection. Or
well, he's an interesting guy. Like he, you know, it's an interesting pairing that the two of you are working on this together, because he also has a very distinct style, production style.
Yes.
When you hear, you know, the John Mellencamp record that he made, you just go, oh right, that's a T-Bone
right.
recording. You know what I mean? And I think you have a very distinct style, both in your you know, directing work and photography.
Well, working with T-Bone, I'm learning that, you know, if you can really figure out what it is you do best, people will come to you for that. Mm. And it's way easier than trying to figure out what everyone wants and
right.
chasing that. I think T-Bone lets people chase him. And the people who listen to his stuff and say, that's not for me, he never gets the call from those people.
Right.
But there's enough people that love what he does
sure.
that he can sort of, you know, he can work in his medium very well.
Right. So so somebody unearthed all these Bob Dylan lyrics that had no music. How did
right.
it come to you?
Well, there was a box that was found in Jeff Rosen's office, mm-hmm. which is the archives of Bob Dylan, and this box had all these lyrics, and Jeff showed them to Bob. And said, what are these? And Bob looked at him and said, oh, I wrote these during the Basement Tapes time, but we never set them to music. They never made it to the, you know, down to the basement, basically. And so an idea was hatched, I don't know exactly how, but that these songs should be sort of set to music by a new generation of artists who could collaborate with a 26-year-old Bob Dylan. Basically.
Wow.
And they could take the words and they could set their own music and create these new songs that were co-written by the new artist and by Bob Dylan.
And
so,
Dylan's totally on board with this?
Dylan was on board with that.
Is he involved in any way in the movie?
He is going to be interviewed for the documentary, and he's also, you know, I think he's just part of the project. He'll be credited as a producer on the record because they're his songs. But you know, you have to remember Dylan started out being more popular as a songwriter for other people than he was as an artist. You know, the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan sold hardly any copies, but Peter, Paul and Mary's Blowin' in the Wind was a giant single.
I didn't actually know that. I had no idea.
Now, I hope we'll have to edit this. I hope I got that right. I hope it is Peter, Paul and Mary. They did Blowin' in the Wind, right?
I think so. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure.
My folk
Cut
knowledge is a bit deficient.
Right. I'm going to look that
okay.
up. But But, you know, so much so that, you know, the Byrds did Mr. Tambourine Man and had a huge hit with it. And this happened to such a level that the Columbia Records PR message for Dylan was, nobody sings Dylan like Dylan. And Columbia bought all these full-page advertisements in magazines trying to get people to listen to Dylan as an artist, because he was almost seen as a, you know, a more of a success as someone who wrote songs for other people. That's so wild. To him, I think even now that, you know, and this is just me speculating, but even now that someone could find his old notebooks and that these songs could go on to be, you know, out there in the world through other artists, it's still a great thing for him, and I think he still enjoys that a lot, you know.
Right.
So these songs came about, and T-Bone and I were tasked with sort of figuring out how to make that into a project, and you know, so it was decided that T-Bone would put together a group of artists and make a record, and I would document the process through the film, and in the course of that, be able to tell the whole history of the Basement Tapes and how they led up to this sort of newest chapter.
Sure.
But I think the film has to tell the story to people about why the original tapes are so significant, why they're so mysterious, and why they engendered the whole bootleg record industry. And it's a very mysterious group of songs, and it's always fascinated musicians, and it's a great story.
Much mythologized period in Dylan's
career. Much mythologized,
too.
Exactly. So, you know, for me, I was as much or more excited about telling that story as I was about taking these current songs and filming current artists, recording them. So,
who are some of the current artists?
So the artists are Elvis Costello, Marcus Mumford, Jim James of My Morning Jacket, Rhiannon Giddens of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and Taylor Goldsmith of Dawes.
Oh, wow.
And those five.
Is there a rhythm section? Are there some backup players in there as well?
And then there's, yeah, T-Bone's got his drummer that he uses all the time, Jay Bella Rose. Mm-hmm. And then there were some guests that came in, like Haim or Haim. There were some guests that came in, like Haim, who did background vocals. And a few other people rolled in and did little flourishes. But it was mostly these five people, and they switched instruments. So Jim James plays bass on it a lot. Taylor Goldsmith plays bass.
How was that? How was the dynamic between, you know, sort of a guy like Elvis Costello, who's been doing it a long time, who, you know, he's not a kid, he's like an elder statesman of that world, and Taylor Goldsmith? Like, how, when they both have an idea for something, who wins that debate? You know what I mean?
Well, it was really interesting because, you know, Taylor walked in there just, you could just see complete shock and awe on his face that he was working with Elvis Costello.
Right.
But Elvis was very much collaborative and did not require that kind of fawning from the people around him. And so within a day or two, you saw this dynamic shift to where there's Taylor Goldsmith and Elvis Costello hunched over some lyrics, and they're writing a song together. Hmm. And Taylor is saying, well, Elvis, what if you went to the minor chord there? And Elvis, well, let me try that. That's great. And so, it, you know, it quickly went from the younger guys being in awe of the older guys to this collaborative thing where people were just working as equals.
Right.
And I found that to be really refreshing, and it didn't feel like a supergroup situation to me. It felt more like a band that was pretty open to ideas and trying different things. And, you know, there was enough time in the studio for everyone to try all their versions. So no one really got their song cut before it got a chance to be recorded.
Right.
In other words, T-Bone didn't say, oh, this song here called Lost on the River, we're going to do Elvis's version.
Right.
He said, hey, if there's time, let's do all your versions. And that way everyone could feel like equals in the studio, and then at a later date, they can decide what's on the record and what's not. So I found that to be really fascinating, and it kind of freed up the musicians to sort of be collaborative on each other's things. Like Marcus Mumford played a lot of drums on this record.
Really?
He did, and that's how he started. He started out as a session drummer
in
England. And so and he loved it.
Right.
All these guys, I think, love not having to carry their bands because they're all front men.
Sure.
And Rihanna is a front woman who's carrying her band in a lot of ways. And they're all able to sort of sit back and, you know, they only had to be the front person once every five times around. Right. So it was, I mean, for Elvis, I think, for him to be able to sit down and play keyboards, which is something he never gets to do because Steve Naive will.
Right,
you know?
Of course.
Or for, you know, for Taylor Goldsmith to be able to, you know, just be a guitar player and just play a solo rather than having to carry the tune.
Yeah, yeah.
So that,
so everybody had their fun.
Right. But, you know, so the project will eventually be on Showtime at the end of the year. And
is the album done?
The album is recorded.
Right.
Basic tracks are recorded, and I think they're mixing now and doing all that stuff.
Will it come out at the same time as the movie?
That's the idea, that they come out together. And for me, the other exciting thing is that the album and the movie can be different. So you can see one version of, say, Lost on the River in the movie, and a different one gets chosen for the record.
Right.
And it allows for a broader scope of these songs to come out in different versions. For instance, I was able to film some of these songs as they were being written. So what you may hear on the record is a completely realized, changed, big orchestrated version of a song. And I have the acoustic version in the hotel room, which may appeal to me more because it feels so new and intimate.
Right.
You know, and I love that aspect of this project, that you can see these songs in various forms of completion. Mm. And you can see artists sort of how they work.
Yeah.
You know, and it was interesting even to see a guy like Elvis Costello, who came in with very sort of, you know, a large stack of demos, and Jim James, who came in with multi-tracked demos.
So did they all have all the lyrics?
They all had all the lyrics in advance. But it was funny, you know, T-Bone said, hey, don't spend too much time with these. Take a look at them, you know, prepare something so we're not just staring at each other blank-faced on the day, like, what do we do? But you got to see how each artist handled that bit of information.
Right.
For instance, Marcus Mumford only wrote one thing, because he thought, well, we should all just come in and write together, so I'm deliberately not going to do anything. And then Marcus showed up and was like, well, wait a minute. Like,
you got multi-track demos.
Yeah, and they've all written all their versions.
Right,
and when
right.
T-Bone says, who wants to go next? You know, there's Elvis saying, well, I've got a version of this and that and this and that.
Yeah.
And so we have film of Marcus scurrying off into the kitchen to try to write a song in 15 minutes.
Really?
Which he often did admirably. I mean, he would go off and come back in 15 minutes with a great song.
Right.
And watching that process was astounding. And I think Marcus realized, like, if I don't do this, my turn's just going to get passed up.
Right, and then it'll be over and that'll be that.
Right, so you saw sort of every level of security.
Right.
Like, Marcus, I think, is one of those guys we're talking about that's fairly secure with himself.
Sure.
So he felt like he could come in and just sort of wing it.
Right.
And then you have a guy like Elvis Costello, who's written hundreds and hundreds of great songs.
Some of the greatest songs of all time.
Who felt like he had to really come in with some, and be really prepared.
Right.
So you got to see sort of behind the curtain into that process.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, fascinating. Well, not only do you have that dynamic of the sort of the veteran guys like Elvis and the young guys, but then it must have been like the elephant in the room is you're also dealing with Bob Dylan fucking lyrics, man. Like, that's huge. You don't want to screw that up.
Well, here's a funny thing, and I don't even think all the artists know this, but Bob was mixing his record in C. So
no.
So the
would
guys,
he sneak in a disguise and pretend to be the assistant engineer?
Well, the guys were in A and B recording. And Dylan was mixing in C, and you can get into the control room of B from C without being seen because it's down the hall. So he would sometimes pop into the control room B and go up to the window and watch the sessions.
Really?
And none of the guys knew when he was in
there. Do you have that on film?
I do not.
Oh,
that was very, very explicitly
if you put your camera on, he will kick it.
But, you know, it's funny because right before we went in, my production designer who helped me, there was a kitchen, and Capitol said that we could sort of rearrange it for filming, and so we were able to take the blinds that were out to make it more light, and we were able to put in a different table so that they could all fit around it. And my production designer came in and did that, and I also gave him a bunch of my books. And I thought, oh, I'll put a bunch of books in there. I'll put a guitar in there. I'll put a Wurlitzer in there. So it's a place where people want to go that actually has good light, and maybe I'll get some footage. So the day before we started filming, my production designer, Matt Davidson, who you've met, you know, whistle while you work kind of guy, runs upstairs to put up some curtains, and there's Bob up there reading the books, you know, going through the books. And, you know, Matt, who will say hi to the Pope as though he's his next door neighbor, says, hey there, how you doing? Oh, that's a good book. I like, you know, and Dylan just put his head down and shuffled right out of the room.
Right, so, right. That's funny.
So Matt was the only person that actually saw him there.
You know, we opened some shows, Foo Fighters opened some shows for Dylan a few years ago when we were doing an acoustic run. It was like a week of shows. I saw him once, like, walk by. I mean, he's like, you know, that sort of adds to what I'm talking about. Like, there's a mystique to that guy that, you know, just he just seems unknowable. He just seems like he's floating in this other, you know, universe away from, you know.
Very much so. In fact, the next day, Matt showed up again and said, you're not going to believe this, but I just saw Bob walking down the street at Santa Monica and Vine. And he's wearing this big coat, and it was like, you know, hot outside, and just added again to his mystery, like that, you know, there's Bob walking this, you know, and not a great neighborhood, Santa Monica and Vine.
Right.
And where was he going?
Yeah.
You know, he's 2 miles from Capitol at that point. So, you know, I've spent time with Dylan in on photo shoots. I shot him in Spain. I shot him in France. Mm. And he definitely, you know, he does his own thing, you right. know, like I think he likes
That's
to walk to shows and he, you know, it's he total mystery and, yeah. and you don't know if half of it is complete subterfuge and not true and you know what I mean?
Sure.
But I think he's definitely one of these guys that has managed to, for an entire career, stay sort of enigmatic and unknowable.
Yeah.
And yet be this completely fascinating songwriter who can sort of get what we're all thinking in a very universal way and be this enigmatic presence in person.
One last thing, and then I'll get out of your hair and let you get back to work here today. But one last thing I wanted to touch on. You know, obviously when we first met each other, we bonded over music.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know if everybody knows like how big of a music fan and, you know, musician and all that you are. And I'm wondering how much, especially considering that you have essentially worked for yourself most of your adult life, like how much do your musical tastes influence how you've sort of planned your career path? You know, the people that you work with, the artists that you take photos of, like is that a direct influence for you?
Well, I would say that when I was young and I didn't know any of these people, I'd never met them or photographed them, I did sort of, I was influenced by their words. Like I did listen to a lot of Bob Dylan and The Clash and, you know, Neil Young and Midnight Oil and Elvis Costello. I listened to a lot of these people growing up who, they really did seem to lead these very well-examined lives in terms of how they wanted to spend their time. And I think I did take this philosophy that I probably totally made up of, you know, time is short and it's better to be making things and participating in things than it is to be an observer or someone who's out just for a good time or whatever. Like, I think I really took a lot from Joe Strummer's offhand lyrics about how to stand up for yourself and how to discern right from wrong and how to be an individual. And I think I've always sort of gravitated towards individuals. And when I do meet someone like that in my professional life, like Tom Petty, for example, who who I think marches to his own drummer completely and has his own philosophy about how to do things. It is very affirming that the people that do the things that I admire, that make the art or the, you know, that I admire, they make their own decisions and they figure out their own path, you know, and it's always affirming to me. So when I meet someone, you know, even like Dave Grohl, who you know better than anybody, you know, there's a guy that makes his own way in life and decides what it is he wants to do and goes after it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people would have been really satisfied being a drummer in Nirvana. And then he got asked to be in Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Right.
Most people would go, done.
Yeah.
Check,
yeah,
life.
Gig for life.
Yeah. And he said no, because I want to be in my own band. Yeah. I want to be singing the songs that I'm writing. And I have such admiration for someone who doesn't take the path that seems always like the safest or the one that will yield the immediate reward.
Right.
And I think that's something, no matter how old you get or no matter how successful you get, you should never forget that at the end of this whole journey, you're going to be sitting there going, how did I spend my time? Who did I choose to spend it with? And what did I choose to do? And what did I make? And what did I leave behind? And I just want to be the architect of that. I don't want someone else to have designed that path for me.
Yeah.
You know, so for me, that's just it, is how to constantly be the architect of my own success and inspiration and not let someone else have that job.
Yeah, that's a good way to live.
Yeah.
We can end it there. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for sitting down and talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
You have been walking the floor. Thank you. I'm going to cut that last part out. The tongue-tied lightning, it's undressed just like cross-eyed strangers. This is not a joke. All right, that was Mr. Sam Jones. Be sure to check out his show off camera, either on DirecTV, or you could go to his website, offcamera.com. And if you want to check out all his beautiful photographs, you can go to samjonespictures.com. And, you know, I checked. I did a quick Google search after our interview. And yes, Sam, it was Peter, Paul, and Mary that did Blowin' in the Wind. Alrighty. We'll catch you next time on Walking the Floor. Adios, amigos! I've been drinking. What was I thinking when we said goodnight?